Okay, that was Eric Zinman on piano, Blaise Sivilla on saxophone, Glynis Loman on cello. The piece was There Were Frogs in the Fog from the album The Great Divide. And now we've got Eric Zinman himself, Eric Zinman, the pianist with a horn. Eric, can you hear me?
That's me, I can hear you.
Okay, so are you the pianist with a horn?
I am the pianist with the horn these days.
Cool.
I'm going on my third year of playing the euphonium.
Oh, cool. you know, Eric, it's great to talk to you again, man. I wish you had stayed longer in Angers.
Me too.
Okay.
It's a beautiful city.
Yeah. So how you doing?
I'm doing really well. I haven't done a lot of performing since I got back to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I applied for a bunch of things and hope to do some things this winter. Probably going to use my house to do some concerts, actually.
Okay, that's cool.
As you know, the piano is not an easy instrument to find in every space that you travel to.
Right. Okay. And, I was going to ask you something. Okay, am I calling Boston?
Actually, I'm in Cambridge, which is, you know, they're almost like peas in a pod.
Oh, yeah, you told me about that.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like one bank of the Charles is Cambridge and the other side is Boston.
Okay. All right. Well, last night I thought about you a lot because I saw this movie, the latest Martin Scorsese movie, which is set in Boston, the Irish Mafia and all. So I thought about Eric Zinman.
I have to go see that.
Yeah, okay.
That's a must. I love Scorsese.
All right.
I'm down with that.
Okay, let's get down to business here.
All right.
Okay, Eric. So, yeah, what we heard... it was a piece from The Great Divide.
That's the first one.
Right. Tell us about the album and your association with Blaise and Glynis Loman.
Sure. Well, I first met Glynis in the late 80s when I was living in Jamaica Plain. And I'd heard about her and my teacher, Bill Dixon, who's really still my biggest influence of all and probably one of the most creative people in music today. She was a student of his, and he told me to seek her out and that she was living around here. And so I met her one evening, and frankly, I'll tell you, the first time I heard Glynis, I couldn't relate to it. I couldn't deal with it. It was beyond me.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, really. My first reaction was not, it didn't reach me right away. And then it did. And I realized, I think of her now as like one of the quintessential cellists in the music, and I did. She threw me for a loop. There were certain things she did. You know, she had certain limitations she worked with,
uh-huh.
And it's hard to express in words. But I would say the sound that she's able to get, the way she can get a wide variety of tones on just one note,
uh-huh.
You know, and then the way she uses space, and the way she can play with any instrument, like whether it's a percussion instrument. Whether it's get a sound like a saxophone or even just play like a bass when she wants.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's quite, she can do a hell of a lot. There's a long variety of things that she's able to do. It's very exciting for me. I hope try to be concise there.
Okay.
My association with her began in the late 80s.
Right. Does she live in Boston, or where does she live?
She's lived a lot of places. Her family lived in Cambridge for a long time.
Uh-huh.
Until recently, and even she was lived in Cambridge, and her brother lived in Cambridge for quite a while. She stands when she plays. You know, most
uh-huh.
cellists do not stand.
They sit down, yeah. Okay.
That's one thing that you may notice watching cello players. And she doesn't... She has a lot more control over her vibrato
uh-huh.
than a lot of string players
okay.
that I've met. Because a lot of them sort of are refugees from the symphony orchestra, and they get into improvisation through a different door. Glynis completely reinvented, I think, the way she plays the instrument.
Okay.
You know?
Has she made any other records?
No.
Oh, okay, she should.
She should.
Okay.
And I think she's on some things that have never been released. She's been in some ensembles with Bill Dixon,
uh-huh.
also ensembles with Jimmy Lyons.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she's worked with a lot of great people. She just, I can't really answer that as a simple answer why, you know, she isn't out there more. She should be, and she should be working more, and that's the best I can tell you.
Right. Okay.
As far as Glynis goes, I mean, there's more I can say about Glynis, but I mean, go ahead, you know, ask me what you want, and
yeah.
I'll try to focus.
Okay. Let's talk about Blaze. Okay, how did the Blaze connection happen?
Blaze is more recent, and I put the ensemble. I put the ensemble together to some degree. I can count the number of times people have asked me to do things
uh-huh.
in my career as a musician.
Uh-huh.
And Blaze, I had a good rapport with Blaze when I first met him, and we talked a lot over the phone. He sort of understood. He realized, you know, hey, piano players, they're not going to like, they don't get out there. You have to, like, go to them. And he called me. I mean, we had done a bunch of things. He had asked me to play on some things. And, you know, that meant a lot to me because very few people, you know, I mean, meaning he obviously liked what I was doing. And I was able to learn a lot of things from him as a player. And also, I had mainly worked with one group for just many, many years. I don't have, like, six projects. I'm not a mercenary like a lot of musicians today. You know, they've got like six projects they're in. They're doing this. They're doing that. I've never been like that. I played with the same ensemble for about 15 years.
15
and
years.
And only recently started to do different things.
Okay.
It's not true that I have done other projects, but they were very brief.
Mm-hmm.
I did some things with Sabir. I had been in some ensembles with Rafe. It's true, but they were very brief things, and I wasn't focused. You know, there were maybe like two gigs or something at a time, and that's fine. I did play with other people, but I really focused with this, and Glynis and Blaze and I, we worked very hard together to get, you know, that kind of intimacy that you hear on that recording, and that was chosen out of like three or four sessions. You know?
Okay.
We selected pieces from a whole bunch of things we'd done, so that's when I say work it out. We worked it out, and those were the best. And Blaze was very helpful in that. He selected the ones that he liked, and he ran it by me, and I agreed. I thought they were great selections. He also helped me with the recording. So he taught me. He really kind of also got me into digital recording, too. He really helped me with that. I was really not that computer-oriented,
uh-huh.
and he helped with that. But I when I first heard him play, I really enjoyed the joyful way he plays from the bottom to the top of the instrument, you know, with a very expressive, very playful, I guess my first reaction when I saw him play with Music in the Foreground, which I know you, in an interview he did with you, some of that music was played with Gesuk Yang.
Yeah.
Gesuk Yeo.
Gesuk Yao, yeah.
Gesuk Yao. What I remember from that group when I first, this is before I played with Blaze, I remember how well I always got the feeling that, you know, Blaze is a real ensemble player, that he wants to link everything that's happening in the ensemble together. I think that's true of a lot of good players that I've worked with. They're real ensemble players.
Uh-huh.
I can't say that's true of every person I've met in the music, but it's definitely true of Blaze, and that made it such a pleasure to play. And he, I think, said that he appreciated the way I was using space. And it really allowed for all these things to happen. I know it's hard to put these things into words.
Right.
But I love the fire in his playing. He knew a lot of the same people I knew. I mean, it's a small group of musicians doing this music in New York, Boston, Philadelphia, I know some Chicago. It's not, and I know some San Francisco, West Coast, but it's not like an enormous number of people.
Okay.
You know, it's a small.
So everybody knows everybody, and everybody plays with everybody else.
To some extent. I wouldn't say we play with everybody else,
mm-hmm.
but we know everybody.
Okay. All right.
Definitely. I mean, and Blaze is definitely a New York person, but originally from Detroit.
Uh-huh.
So he's been in New York a long time.
And he does a lot of work in New York. I mean, as a musician and organizer.
Well, yeah, as an organizer, I would say, but I don't see anyone doing a lot at mm-hmm. any one time in New York, although
yeah.
Blaze, he's been out there a while, so he's probably getting more opportunities, and good for him. He should be working more.
Uh-huh, okay.
You know.
Cool. All right. Yeah. Shall we get back to the pianist?
Oh, you mean me?
I mean you.
Okay. Yeah, no, I enjoyed playing on the recording. I liked the way we make space for each other. I think there's also, you know, there's some good fire in it, in the sense that I like it when people scream on their instruments or make those vocal kind of expressions like they're talking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's authentic to me.
Right.
And even in terms of the tradition of the music, I think that's authentic.
Right.
You know, it's not that people necessarily care about, you know, tradition here or there. I mean, I guess the only definition I ever had for musicians in this music that was worth anything to me was Gunther Schuller once said, he said it's that originally he used the term jazz musician, which is, I guess, okay. He said a jazz musician was supposed to play the instrument like nobody else. Of course, these days that isn't necessarily true. You hear a lot of people that sound the same.
Mm-hmm.
But that's at least what I'm going for, trying to find out what I can do on the piano.
Okay.
No, not necessarily just for the sake of being different, but just to find out what it is that I can do.
Okay.
There's a bunch of different things I can do on the piano that I've learned to do or tried to get myself to do. I try to do a full range from the whole, first of all, use the whole instrument from the bottom to the top. I can play single lines, you know, try to sound like a horn. I don't think the piano's greatest strength is to try to sound, you know, one line, you know, like the way Bud Powell played, you know, from that period, people were really trying to translate the horn onto the piano, so you have all these myriads of notes like that sound, you know, in a way in the realm of Charlie Parker, trying to do that on the piano, and all these one-line things.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one personality that the piano has.
Right.
You know, you try to play a wide range of things from, like, bass sounds to horn sounds to huge blocks of sound, which the piano, of course, does very naturally, you know,
right,
in the way it is. Does any of this make any sense? Am I speaking a language that's...
Yeah, well, yes. It
okay.
Does, it does, it does.
I can be clear if I can focus. It's hard to talk about music. It's not the...
Right.
You know.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Those are some things I've tried. The use of the pedal with the piano is a real problem.
Right.
You know, you'll know... Well, maybe problem isn't the right word, but you listen to different players, you notice some players use a lot more pedal than others.
Right.
You know, like McCoy Tyner uses an enormous amount of pedal.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Evans uses a lot of pedal.
Okay.
Bud Powell, Thelonious Monk, very spare with the pedal.
All right.
You know, I mean, so I think that's also something that's always on my mind, you know, the balance between the pedaled and the non-pedaled sounds.
Right.
That's a very tricky thing about the piano, how to get that right.
Okay.
You know, too much pedal, it gets kind of watercolor. Even, you know, it might be a little dull after a while if you just constantly hear the pedal. You know, anyways, these are things that pianists, I think any pianist has to think about, not just me.
Okay.
But, and I think in saying that, I'm revealing something about my playing.
Yes, Eric, you are.
Yeah.
All right. gonna...
you know, dynamics, most people know how to play soft and they know how to play loud. What I don't hear in a lot of musicians that I definitely strive for is that middle, the whole range within,
okay,
a little softer, a little louder, a little flatter, a little, all these degrees. That's one way I find that you can really draw listeners in, by really focusing on that. I think that's something I'm only recently starting to really focus in on the last 5 years, but dynamics. I mean, I definitely work the piano. I've spent a lot of time working with percussion, so I play the piano in that way. I really try to push the drummers on, the drummers push me. I use the low register a lot to do that because it's very powerful.
Uh-huh.
You know, almost like gongs that you hear. The low register of the piano can really sound like a gong.
Okay.
And I use that to affect at times. I do a little playing on the inside, but not like an enormous amount. I think on the second cut on there, I do some, play it like a harp, where you get the inside or even scratching sounds on the strings. Glittis
right.
does that on the cello too.
Right.
Just some great scratching sounds, you know, as well as, you know, beautiful vibrato. I mean, she does the full range.
Okay.
From the tension, from the release. Anyways,
All right, Eric. All right. We'll talk more about your piano playing, but first we gotta take a break, and which is going to be a piece from the Eric Zinman Ensemble album on CJR Records. It's with Eric Zinman on piano, John Voigt on bass, Lawrence Cook on drums. The album is called Eric Zinman Ensemble on CJR Records. We'll be back just after this. That was In the Mystery, composed by Eric Zinman and performed by Eric Zinman on piano, John Voigt on bass, and Lawrence Cook on drums from the album Eric Zinman Ensemble on CJR Records. Eric, we're back.
I'm back with you. Thank you so much for playing that. It's such great to work with John Voigt and Lawrence Cook. I mean, they're kind of like mentors to me. You want me to elaborate Lawrence Cook should be touring the world now, playing everywhere. I mean, I don't know what. I know you have to be proactive, you always have to ask people for things, but I think he's one of the finest drummers to emerge from the 60s, without a doubt, and as evidenced by his recordings with Bill Dixon, November 1981, Son of Sisyphus, and Thoughts, I think there's some others too. Even his ESP recordings with Alan Silva, he's really, and it's about a lot of people he worked at. He taught me so much. He was always never, how to use space, and I guess I haven't worked with John Voight that long. I think we started working, I'm not sure exactly when we started working together. Maybe it was 2002. I'm not sure. It might have been earlier, but came later. But I'd always been a fan of John Voight's. Used to watch him play in many, many situations. And he's another one who should be where they should both be working a lot. What else could I say? I know it's my ensemble with my name on it and all that, but it's because, of course, I have to organize everything. I have to get the gigs on the piano player. But it's really a collaboration.
Right.
I have about three pieces on there that have my name on them. You see, John Voight has a couple, but so much of my playing was built around Lawrence's playing. I began working with him in the late, 89. And, 88, 89, he used to bring his drums over my house, and we played every week, and I was working with a bass player named Craig Schildauer at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Working with drummers, I don't know, some of them have a very strict idea of what time is supposed to be. You know, there were some drummers I'd work with, they'd always say, oh, no, you're dragging. Others would say, no, you're playing too fast. You know, you just can't win. With Lawrence, it was just always a beautiful, graceful experience. He used to say, he just mumbled to me, he would say, play the pretty chords, Eric. I'd put him in the right place.
Okay.
And he allowed me to experiment with using space, to place my sound in different ways. And he always surrounded it with these wonderful cymbal sounds. And Lawrence is another person also who does quite a wide variety of things on the trap set.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who has any of his recordings, they've got to listen to the sound he's able to get out of each of those drums, because it's a very special sound. When we did the recording, I know he did not want any compression.
Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar, but in recording studios, it's very popular these days to put compression on things to make the sound clearer.
Mm-hmm.
What
right.
that does is it takes away all the harmonics that are natural to the sound.
Okay.
And we wanted to leave that, to hear all the various vibrational frequencies that come out of those cymbals. So that, very happy with the engineer on that, Peter Contremus. He's had the opportunity to record us, or record Lawrence a number of times. John Voight is, not just a bass player, he's a writer, he's a poet, and he gets an opportunity on the CD to talk to you in his piece Swing Swang Swung, which he sort of bases on Lawrence's sort of fantasy about channeling Gene Krupa.
Mm-hmm.
We had all these different things that we would do pieces. Sometimes the piece would just be, I would start it at the piano.
Hey, isn't that piece Little Jimmy K?
You're right, it's Little Jimmy K. I'm wrong. You corrected me. You're right. Swing Swang Swung is also one of his pieces.
Yeah, it is.
Talk in that one. You got it. I can't even remember my own music.
Little Jimmy K, yeah. I love
You're
the
right.
piece.
Right, Little Jimmy
yeah.
K, that's where he gets to talk and do...
Yeah.
And I used to see him for years doing these, like, skits, these poems of his while he played.
Oh, that's beautiful. And
so this is just one in a line of things he's been doing for years.
Oh. Oh, he should be recording more.
Everybody should be doing more.
Exactly. Eric, you should be doing more too, yes. That's right. I was about to say that.
Yes, then you get into these grand conversations about, well, governments
right.
should be spending more
exactly.
money on the arts.
So,
but I know McKinney just introduced a bill to impeach Bush today, but we'll see how far that goes.
Okay.
Congresswoman from Georgia.
Okay.
But, no one's gonna care. No one's gonna care.
All right. Getting back to music, Eric. Are you guys getting together ever again, John Voight?
Oh, of course. Oh, no. The whole point about, the only reason this music sounds the way it does is because we're dedicated to making, continuing, evolving.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to meet them on, actually, this coming Monday.
Okay, so you meet regularly.
Well, I have to say, we don't meet as regularly as we used to, partly because personal issues, work, gainful employment.
Right.
Lawrence lives in Rhode Island, which is a little farther away now. He doesn't live as close as he used to. But I'm in touch with them. I mean, they're, you know, that's the ensemble for me. And, I'm very happy with the CD. It's a fantastic CD.
Yeah. And are you aware of the public response to this movie? This CD?
I think it might be a little early.
Yeah, okay.
It came out 6 months ago, maybe.
Oh, okay.
At the most.
Mm-hmm.
It was recorded in 2004, but it only came out like about something like that, like not that long ago.
Okay.
I've had one review in a German publication called Bad Alchemy.
Okay. I think somebody is going to review it in Impro Jazz. Are you aware of that magazine in France? Impro Jazz.
No, I'm not. And
I think
I'm
somebody's
totally
going to do it.
Excited by the idea that someone will review the music.
Because, yeah. You know what? If I were good at it, if I had this gift of the gab, I would do it myself. But I don't. So I'll let people who are better qualified to do it.
I have trouble reviewing other people's music myself.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm having a hard enough time talking about it.
Right.
You know, it's. I mean, there is something intangible about music. I have, like, you know, we've conversations for like years and years about how to approach things and what you can do on the piano and my reflections on other players and how they play and what in that I can use. I mean, we all have these conversations, you know, so that helps a little bit, but it's not literature, but
right. And I have a very good question for you here. You came to Angers, you played with Didier Lasserre and Benjamin Dubuc. And how is that experience playing with these two musicians different from playing with the guys you play with, Eric, John Voight and Lawrence Cook and others?
Well, first of all, like, John Voight and Lawrence Cook are another generation.
Uh-huh.
All right? And people have heard that music, and, you know, Didier and Benjamin, I think, are closer to my age.
Okay.
Or either my age or older, I don't know, but we're pretty close together in age.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was interesting. We were all into the same music.
Okay.
You know, and it's only because of Jean-Luc Guinet that I was referred to them. You know, he kind of hooked me up with them in communication.
Okay.
And but how it was different? Well, I think you know, it's funny. In many ways, there were a lot of things that were the same. I mean, nobody plays like Lawrence Cook, for one thing.
Okay.
or John Voight. I mean, they're unique players. But there's a certain understanding about the music that all of these people seem to have. And Didier and I talked, and Benjamin. We all liked a lot of the same stuff.
Okay.
We had our differences in places, you know, and it was always interesting to hear about their likes and their dislikes and the music they dug. Didier gave me some Jimmy Lyons recordings that I'd never heard.
Okay.
This is one intangible thing about the drummers of the 60s. You know, they had a way of playing time that was very understated. People like Sonny Murray. I mean, if you think about how this whole approach to the music began and who the players were doing it. And you could tell that these guys have all heard that and have all done. Of course, Lawrence was in the formative years when people first began to play this way. But, I noticed Didier has a way of using space. It's very relaxed, very graceful. He gets a very warm sound out of the drums. And he was very easy to play with for that reason. He's just, you know, very laid back makes good use of you know, he did a wide range. You know, so I was afraid, you know, there's some improvisers, they're just very timid.
Mm-hmm.
Didier did, you know, even Didier's most delicate sounds were very strong.
Okay.
And And then he's not afraid to hit the drums hard and get a huge, you know, get a nice snapping sound at times. It's he does the full range. He makes it very easy. Benjamin does a wide range of things, from like playing pizzicato to just getting these big, large bowed sounds that would just gel with the piano,
right.
And would were very supportive, like a real under sound, like a cushion to do things on. And you know, how it was different is difficult to say. You know, I have noticed some difference with the American players. You know, I mean, different. But I saw Benjamin do some swing in Paris that I thought was pretty strong.
Okay.
I was surprised. He was sweating. I mean, he was. I think it's more personality. I think, you know, different personalities are going to play differently. But as far as the philosophy and aesthetic, I think we all share the same. I think the way they use space was definitely different. I know there were some long spaces that both Benjamin and Didier would use when I did the concert. I don't know about the one at Angers. Yeah, I remember a solo in Angers that Didier did where he would do these long pauses.
Uh-huh.
I thought that was almost a little personal mark of his, maybe. I'm not sure how to talk about the differences.
Eric,
I'm sorry, I did my best.
Yeah, Benjamin told me that he sent you the recording. Did you listen to the recording?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
It seemed much, much better than I thought.
Oh, okay.
It's
cool.
Really, you know, yeah, that's the thing, recordings, you really need good recordings to listen to, because it can really turn, that's why we're so, you know, temperamental about what we put out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very temperamental, because people aren't gonna think anything other than what they hear.
Right.
So it's a good recording. The piano in Angers was bad, definitely better than the one I played in Paris, because it was a grand.
Mm-hmm.
I left a lot of space, I think, in that. And you know what? I listened to the Angers was a long one. There were like two CDs in there.
Oh, okay.
But what can I say about it? I don't know. I mean, the people seemed to love it. They were such a great audience. They were quiet, and they asked us for more. I don't get that response here. I really don't.
Really?
No, they don't like cheer and ask for more.
Uh-huh.
At least not. I don't know. All the art forms are marginalized, so I don't want to, like, I don't think I'm special in that sense. I mean, we all have a long, you know, hard road to deal with. I don't want to generalize about American audiences either, because, you know, we generally play for very small audiences here, you know,
right.
Like 10 to 15 people,
mm-hmm.
You know. And so Angers was a fairly large audience for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, but you know what? I talked to people like, I haven't talked to Matt Shipp, but I've heard from other players, you know, all the New York players, these great players that you play in your show, they're playing for like shows of like 10 or 15 in New York.
Uh-huh, right.
So it's no different.
Okay. All right.
So.
Oh, so it's okay. It's the same thing for everybody.
Well, if it's,
I mean,
okay,
yeah,
or
it's not,
not,
I mean,
don't know.
No, no.
It's no different wherever you go.
Yes.
My situation isn't unique, that's all.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right. Shall we take a break?
Sure.
Cool. What would you like me to play?
Maybe we should just play a little Jimmy Kay. I mean, the
Jimmy
funny
Kay.
Thing about it is when people in other countries heard it, the English is a little awkward for them, because he speaks in a kind of an English American dialect. They didn't seem to get it.
Right.
I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I just thought it was funny. It's a funny way of doing it. And, sure, there are a few things that I did not, a few words here and there that I had difficulty catching, but then I caught on.
You get the that he's talking about
a hipster.
A UFO.
Yeah, UFO chick.
Right, UFO chick.
I love that one.
Right, and she wants to, like, make make
a million
more,
zillion
a zillion, yeah, and so she chooses this musician to mate with.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, now you get it. So that's,
yeah, I just love it. I just love it. I wish I could do that. It's beautiful. Okay, let's play that one.
Yeah, definitely. Because mystery is very seems kind of like a serious piece. So this one has a sense of humor. So sure, let's do it.
Okay. Oh, where is it? Oh, where did I put the CD?
Little Jimmy K. You were right. You picked it out.
Yeah, Little Jimmy K.
I couldn't even remember.
Love the story. I should send an email to John Voight asking him permission to perform this. So whenever I could, his poem Jimmy K.
Oh yeah, yeah. Email him john.voight@comcast.net,
okay.
And he'd love to hear from you. I'm just trying to think. My impression is that he really believes this stuff, though.
Okay.
It's not just a story.
Okay, I should talk to him about that.
You should.
Okay. All right. Let's listen to this piece called Little Jimmy K. On va écouter ce morceau qui s'appelle Little Jimmy K. In the White Hipster. Composé par John Voight. Les mots sont écrits par John Voight et Eric Zinman nous vient de dire que John Voight n'est pas seulement un contrebassiste mais aussi un écrivain et un poète. Alors on écoute ce poème de John Voight en compagnie de Lawrence Cook à la batterie, Eric Zinman au piano. Les mots de ce poème sont complètement improvisés. Little Jimmy Kay.
Studs and pretties, lend me your ears, you...
Okay, all right.
Cats and kitties, studs and pretties, lend me your ears, you dig. Lend me your ears out there. Because I'm about to lay a story on you. Ooh, baby, 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 baby. Eric's going to help me with this. And Lawrence is going to help me with this. Because this is a story about... Little Jimmy K, the hippest. The hippest of the white hipsters, you understand. Ooh. Papa Chikuli, Papi Tuchiku. Now, Jimmy K, he, being hip, you understand, had certain situations that brought him into a place of pleasure, of joy, of ecstasy, which he dug very heavily, very heavily. And namely, they revolved around two kind of basic concepts. One would be what is politely known as substance abuse, and the other would be what is politely known as chicks, you dig, chicks. Mm-hmm. Well, to move the story right along, little Jimmy K would pop and lid and blow and smack and pack and flip and, ooh, baby, this feels good. I'm so hip. Ooh, I'll take some poor, I'll sniff and short, snort and pop and bloop, boop, chakoo. I cool your mop, I'm so hip. I dig bird, I dig bird. Oh, he's his cowboys. Go, little Jimmy K. And then, of course, chicks. Despite cats that would have problems in the moor scene when they got too twisted behind juice, little Jimmy K was just Casanova, just slick Casanova. But he met his match with Bertha. I gotta tell you about Bertha. Now, Bertha was a strange chick. She had no neck, which was kind of a situation. And she had only a slit for a nose and she had only a slit for a mouth, but she had these big oriental eyes. And you see, Bertha said she was like that because she was from outer space. She was a UFO chick. I believe her. Yes. Oh, go, Bertha. Go, Bertha. Now, Bertha went up to little Jimmy K and said, "We got a thing we got to do, Jimmy K." And Jimmy K said, "Even though you have no neck and no nose and no mouth, of course, is the thing I want to do with you. But first, let's get high." She said, "Cool." And they got high. And then Bertha laid it on him. She wanted to take little Jimmy K and make about 17 trillion zillion billion little Jimmy K hybrids and seed them through galaxies. Ooh. Jimmy say, "I'm down." Jimmy K started. But it was even too much for little Jimmy K, and he dropped dead. Ba-boom, Bertha split on her UFO. Zazoom. But up there in heaven, not only was Bertha's UFO, but was little Jimmy K, and he went up to the pearly gates, and the pearly gates cat, the angel said, come on here. So he came on in, and he went to the nightclub, God's Place it was called, and there was, lo and behold, Heaven Come True, Bird and Diz, and Miles and Wardell, and Thelonious Monk, and Art Blakey, and all the cats, and little Jimmy K got one of the angels' harps, and he started, oh boy, let me sit it now, and you know, they were kind to him, they gave him a couple of courses on ornithology, and, Jimmy K was happy, but then he wanted to get a little bit of taste, you know, the stuff he liked to drink and basically imbibe and get snorted and poked and, you know, all that stuff. But he noticed that Bird was over in the corner drinking a glass of orange juice, and Diz was over in the other corner drinking a glass of carrot juice, and Miles Davis was eating a bean sprout and tofu sandwich on Syrian bread, and it suddenly became clear to little Jimmy K that these cats were all on a health kit. So little Jimmy K, being a follower of the hippest cats around, which of course would be Bird and Diz and Miles and Wardell and all them cats and friends and everything like that. Go little Jimmy K, go little Jimmy K, go little Jimmy K. Yes, yes, yes. He started with the tofu sandwiches and the orange juice and the carrot juice and the splibbly splat and the blittily blat and all that stuff that you could get in health food stores. And suddenly, Jimmy K changed. He had dropped dead from the other stuff. Now, he dropped out of heaven. He dropped alive. Ooh, Bob's your babe. Cool your mom. New tempo, new cat on the scene. Little Jimmy, he's clean. Last time we saw, little Jimmy had a yoga studio that sold tofu to somewhere in Berkeley, California.
Okay, Jimmy K, the hippest. That was Little Jimmy K, the White Hipster by John Boyd.
I have to tell you one little story about it. When that was done, the concentration to play and talk at the same time, and then like be able to listen to what Lawrence and I are doing. So it was a bit much. I mean, we do it live, but since we were in the studio, John said, "Look, let me do this without you." So he did it without me, and then I did my track over him.
Oh, okay.
I mean, there's no way you'd know, because we just play, you know, so well together anyways. Yeah. I don't think I would have been able to tell, but it worked.
Uh-huh, okay.
It worked that way, for whatever that's worth.
All right. Good. Yeah. Okay, that's beautiful. I'm going to shoot him an email.
Yeah, too. Really nice guy.
Yeah.
Okay. They're all really nice, all of these people, every single one of them.
Right. Okay.
You know, they don't have. They're not mean. None of them.
Right.
You know Blaze. Yeah, talked with him.
Yeah. And I think this trio comes out of the Bill Dixon connection, isn't it?
Perhaps. I mean, that's how I first saw Lawrence play.
Yeah.
And it's true. I also saw Voight playing with Bill Dixon in the 80s.
Yeah.
And that's where I saw them. I was a student at Bennington College.
Right.
So yeah, in that sense, you're right.
Right. And you said that Bill Dixon is one of your mentors.
Well, he's a mentor for a lot of these, some of these guys too. I don't want to mention names like in that sense, because I mean they may have their own opinion. But I know with Lawrence, I think I had this discussion with Lawrence that he was working with Dixon back in the mid to like 67, 66 with the University of Streets.
Uh-huh.
A lot of musicians connected with Bill during that period in New York.
All right.
I don't know if you know what the University of Streets was, but it was a local program that was funded, and it was in a church.
Okay.
Possibly the Judson Church, and Bill has a lot of recordings of that period. I hope they get released someday.
Okay.
A lot of people came out of that. Some famous people. But I don't want to mention names because I'm not sure exactly about all of them. But I suspect some very well-known people haven't maybe discussed their connections with that. University of Streets was a great program. I think it still exists today in New York.
Okay, the University of Streets.
It's called the University of... It was called that, and it still is today, I believe.
Okay.
It's pretty marginalized, and I don't know what kind of activity they're doing. I have to go sometimes and check it out.
Okay.
But that was a program where Dixon did a lot of writing and brought in people who were students or people who were willing, and they did pieces of his pieces.
Okay.
Large ensembles, too. I mean, like 20, 30, huge, huge things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, when I think back, I get the feeling it was a very fertile time where people could test out ideas and share them, and maybe real estate wasn't so expensive so that you could get a space to do stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's so difficult just to get a room to get people together in, and then, you know, and then have an audience. I'm sure it might be easier in France. I don't know if you have the zoning laws we have here. Like, I'm technically not allowed to do a concert in my house.
Uh-huh.
I have an entertainment license.
Okay.
I don't know
okay.
if you have that in Alger or Paris.
I'm not sure. There are people who throw private parties where they have concerts in their houses.
Okay.
So, yeah, well, I'm not sure.
Well, the reason it's important for me to talk about this is just because generally we have not played in clubs.
Uh-huh.
I have to admit, that club in Paris, it's called Rue Léon.
Rue Léon, yeah.
No, Café Olympique.
Olympique. Café Olympique, yeah.
That is, I mean, it didn't, I mean, it was, maybe it was a club, but people, like, were sitting in an audience, and they were totally quiet the whole time we were playing.
Uh-huh.
It didn't feel like a club.
Uh-huh.
That's what we're used to. We're used to playing in front of an audience that are there to see us. When you play in clubs, sometimes people aren't necessarily there to see you. They're there to have dinner.
Right.
And you just happen to be there.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly. I know
so
what you mean.
Yeah, okay.
Uh-huh. So what do you prefer?
Well, I mean, I prefer some situation where people come to see you play.
Uh-huh.
They're not there to have dinner. I mean,
right.
I've generally done schools, libraries, museums, art galleries. Sure, auditoriums if you can get them, concert halls. Those are the places I like to play,
right.
And have always played.
Okay.
But that means I do very few concerts.
Right.
It's not like you know, like Thelonious Monk playing every week at the Five Spot.
Right.
You know,
right.
I don't think there is anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
At least not where I live. Maybe in New York there is still some of that. I know. Blaze has tried to keep ABC going.
Right.
Well, it's not, ABC is not his, it's called Coma.
Coma, yeah.
Which he told you about.
Yes,
he did. His ontological musical agenda. So there's people like, you know, him and, you know, trying to keep situations like this going. I've been an organizer over the years. I've presented a lot of concerts. And, you know, little by little, there is some exposure.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Next question.
So are you playing these days a bit with somebody or what?
I've actually been working on some trio stuff with Glynis and
okay.
a drummer named Sid Smart.
Oh, Sid Smart, Sidney Smart, who played
Sidney
with Jimmy Lyons? No,
I'm sorry.
Who played with Jimmy Lyons?
I think he did.
Sid Smart.
In fact, he is on that box set. You're right.
That's
he
a
did.
Name that rings a bell.
He lives in Cambridge near me, and he's definitely a brother.
Sidney Smart.
He's,
okay.
You know, we're on very good terms. He's a great guy to know and talk to. He's got tons of stories to tell,
and
he's also another amazing drummer.
Oh, that's cool.
So I've been working with Sid and Glynis and combining that with Blaze when Blaze comes down,
mm-hmm.
and then I still have the three piece ensemble with John Voight and Lawrence Cook, and I'm thinking about maybe, you know, bringing in a guest to maybe with that ensemble at some point, but we just have so few gigs that I just try to keep it simple.
Right.
That's all.
Any plans to come to Europe back again?
Yes.
Yes.
Such a good time. I can't resist.
Right.
I can't say that, you know, I mean, they didn't throw money at me or anything, and they're not, I haven't gotten any plane tickets, but
mm-hmm.
The people that I connected with, it was just so special, and the audience really were great.
Right.
Such that, and of course that means I want to work harder on my French, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because
okay.
So, no, but I had a great time in Europe. I like the atmosphere, the climate, the sort of... I do get the feeling that being an artist in Europe is not such... It's not like... You're not such a freak. Even I talk to people in England, you know, lots of people go to art school, they get out, and they may do other things, but no one says anything to you that, oh, you went to art school? Like, nobody makes a big deal about it.
Uh-huh.
It's just another thing people do. Here, it's a little strange, you know, you go to art school, immediately you're subjugated.
Really?
That's the feeling I get socially.
Okay.
I don't feel that the climate, my feeling about the arts, I use the term art, I didn't instead of saying music, because I believe that the problem in one art is the same in all the arts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that music is isolated from that. And my feeling about the arts in the U.S. is that it's fine as long as it's in church or summer camp. But once it gets into the adult world, you know, when you're not a kid anymore, it's something you want to discourage your kids from doing.
Okay.
Not that I blame them when you consider, you know, what your options for employment might
be.
But that's, I just never felt the encouragement here that I felt over in Europe.
Okay.
That's all I'll say. I'm not going to say the money was, you know, I know that, you know, that we go through phases of conservative governments and progressive governments, whatever. But I just think there's a historical climate that is very kind to the arts. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, right. You're right.
And, you know, from a personal social point of view.
I mean,
I would talk to people in stores and about music sometimes, and they weren't. It wasn't a total stranger type thing for them. Some of the people I mentioned, and like when I was in Amsterdam, and my tactic was always to try to mention. If someone says, what kind of music do you do? I would always say, you know, choose their players and say, like them. So in Amsterdam, the guy says to me, what kind of music do you do? I said, like ICP.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew immediately what I was talking about.
Okay.
You know, and it was just some guy I met. So, you know, here in the U.S., you go into a bar and talk to someone about, I mean, people don't even know who Cecil Taylor is. You know, I mean, it just, you know.
Right.
I know he's famous and all, but, you know, they don't even, you ask them, like, is there anybody who plays piano that you've heard?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you can ask them who their favorite football player is, you know, and they'll know right away. But when it comes to, you know, instrumental players, I don't know if. But I you have to be very careful with generalizations, because you can find the same culture anywhere you go.
Right.
You know, you just have to. You know, I think I said that in the interview in Paris, you know, like, you know, you go to some countries, you know, and like the U.S., and everyone walks the same way, works the same job, drives the same car, their kids go to the same school, they eat at the same place for dinner, but you meet someone who's different everywhere
right.
you go, so, I know.
Cool. All right. Eric.
Yeah.
I think it's time to go.
Oh, very good.
But I don't want to rush you. Is there anything else you would like to talk about?
No, it was a long interview. I mean, and I really appreciate it, and it's great to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you.
It's you know, you love the music, and it's great to meet, you know, that you can travel and share ideas like this.
Right.
Because it just doesn't happen every day.
So.
So, you know, not just my music, but this music. We got to keep it going. And,
right.
That's it, you know. And you're right about Angers. It is absolutely beautiful.
It's beautiful. I told you that, huh? I tell everybody that. It is beautiful.
You were right. You're right. It really is. It's
so
one of the cleanest cities I've ever been in.
Right. When can I expect you back in Angers?
I'm trying to come back next year.
Oh, okay, cool.
I'm not sure exactly the time. I'm applying to some festivals, and if I get in, that'll determine the time.
Festivals or clubs? I mean, performance spaces.
Well, anything. I mean, anything I can get.
Yeah,
I mean,
okay, cool.
Clubs were a good experience for me in France.
Mm-hmm.
And also, this place I played in Berlin, Strahlau 68... I guess you could. I'm not sure if you'd call it a club. I mean, it was set up just like these performance spaces.
Mm-hmm.
What's nice is, you know, they're not uptight about alcohol in Europe. So, you know, everyone drinks the best beer. At least in Berlin, they do.
Mm-hmm.
And it was inexpensive. and you didn't need a liquor license to, you know, to sell beer.
Right.
It was totally laid back, so that's what I liked, you know, and I still remember the wonderful meal in Angers, Pinon, the Cabernet Franc that we drank. I don't remember.
Yeah, and we were late for the gig.
Yeah, I know we were late, and I might have, you know, might have been a little tough on my digestion.
Right.
Play right after, but it worked out. We were having such a good time.
Okay.
No, I look forward to seeing you again, and I've been listening to your show. I just want you to know it's an incredible show, and I was listening today to Didier playing with that saxophone player Silva.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's just, it's really good because I'm getting to hear some stuff that I wouldn't normally hear because I don't buy a ton of CDs all the time.
Right, they're expensive.
So I'm very grateful. So yeah. Keep doing it, Taran, and I'll tell other musicians about it.
Yeah, Eric, spread the word.
Right.
Thank you so much, and I hope to talk to you soon and see you soon next year. I hope to see you soon.
You will, Taran.
Okay.
Take care. And,
yeah, Eric.
And have a good warm winter.
Yeah. Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Just keep me posted, okay?
I will. Take care.
Bye. Bye-bye.
All right, that was Eric Zinman with us. Eric Zinman from Cambridge, near Boston. Let's sign off with a piece from the album that's called Eric Zinman Ensemble on CJR Records, with Eric Zinman on piano, John Voigt on bass, Lawrence Cook on drums. The piece is called... All right, let's listen to this. It's called Elephant Paws, composed by Eric Zinman. And with this, avec ça, je vous souhaite une bonne soirée, bonne nuit, bon dimanche et à samedi prochain avec beaucoup de nouvelles musiques. Et pour avoir les détails de toute la musique que vous écoutez, vous allez sur le site de l'émission www.tfjh.blogspot.com. Je vous souhaite une bonne nuit. Au revoir, à samedi prochain.